I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, Midday on Ethics. Medical researchers use clinical trials to develop treatments and medication. But what happens when the human subjects of those trials don't reflect society as a whole? Why is so much medical research still done overwhelmingly with white subjects, and more often with men than women? And what are the consequences of that, particularly for women and people of color? For example, African Americans have a significantly higher incidence of Alzheimer's disease than Caucasians, and they are also significantly underrepresented in clinical trials studying the disease. We'll explore that connection with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Research and Diversity, Midday, starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday on this kind of muggy, sunny afternoon here in Baltimore. I hope it's sunny and not so muggy where you are, although chances are that's probably not the case. We are not going to spend the hour, however, talking about the weather. We're going to spend the hour talking about ethics. It's another edition of Midday on Ethics. And today we're going to have a conversation about clinical trials and diversity. Why is so much medical research still done with white subjects, and more often with men rather than with women? And what are the consequences of that, particularly for women and people of color? And if clinical trials are done by examining only parts of our society, what does that mean for the efficacy of the findings? How reliably can those results be extrapolated to apply to the rest of the population? And what are the consequences when the research is then used to develop treatments? Will those treatments be effective for everyone, or primarily just for the group at the heart of the research? To wit, African Americans have a far greater incidence of Alzheimer's disease and a far lower rate of inclusion in clinical trials. So what, if any, is the connection between those two realities? Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He stops by Midday from time to time to talk about how ethicists help us frame complex questions like these. Jeff, it's good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And you are welcome to join our conversation as well. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. So, Jeff, let's start first by talking about the sort of the scope of this. Is it true, and why perhaps is it true? Well, first of all, is it true that most of the subjects of clinical trials are white men?
Historically, it is absolutely true. Policies change. So if we think about where the motivations or incentives or actual requirements come from, the NIH, National Institutes of Health, the federal body that funds the vast majority of biomedical research in this country, changed policy in the mid-1990s to require inclusion of women and people of color in clinical research. Now, what it meant in practice was you need to defend if you excluded those groups. So you wouldn't necessarily, obviously, include women in a prostate cancer clinical trial. But you needed to say that. You didn't just include white men and go merrily about your way if you were doing clinical research. Historically, there was a very good reason for it, and it wasn't about sexism or racism. It was about the history of taking advantage of certain populations in research and then the perception of that on the part of those groups. So think of the
Tuskegee.
Tuskegee. Not just Tuskegee as an example. Tuskegee is the example. And so when...
Well, remind folks what Tuskegee was. This is a study about syphilis done in, what was the time frame?
It started in the 1930s, mm-hmm. but it only ended in the 1970s. And so part of that story, and it was performed in and around Tuskegee, Alabama, hence the reference to Tuskegee syphilis study, although that wasn't its actual name. That was a study of the natural history of syphilis in African-American men. And during the course of the years, those 40-some years, antibiotics were discovered and made widely available, but the men in that study were followed all the way through to the endpoint of the study, which was their death. And so they were actually not given antibiotics when they became available, which was the widely used therapy for syphilis in people who had that disease, well after those men should have gotten it. And so that became public only because the New York Times wrote a story about it on the front page above the fold, which to people who remember what newspapers actually look like, the paper ones, that was the most important place for a story. So above the fold, on the left side of the New York Times in 1972, that story was broken, and that led to congressional hearings and a change in policy, a protection environment got promulgated, got implemented from the government, from the NIH.
And because so, here's an example of African Americans being taken advantage of or being that's understating it.
Deceived, misled.
They're deceived, misled, and not treated for treatable diseases.
Correct, and taken advantage of in the process. And over the course of those years, in the 1930s, there wasn't good treatment for syphilis, but the men who were recruited had the disease, so they weren't given the disease as a function of their participation, but they were told they would be treated, which in fact was not true. They were just followed. And then when treatment became available, it was not offered to them. And in fact, lists of the men in that study were circulated to the clinics in and around that part of Alabama. And it said, if these men come, don't treat them with antibiotics. They're in some kind of special research.
So they really went out of their way.
They did.
To deny them treatment.
And so as a result of that, there were policies instituted that said we need to protect people so that they aren't used in research in the ways that we had seen happen. And there were other cases too. This was just the one that most people know about. And the concern there is obviously deception, withholding of what was available therapy at the time, lack of informed consent. But also from an ethics perspective, in addition to those things, it was risk to the people in the research for benefit that would go to other people. So the men in the Tuskegee trial were never going to see the benefits of that research, right? And so the splitting apart is an injustice was embedded in that the way that research was crafted and carried out. And so the policies changed to make sure that wouldn't happen again. But in that process, certain groups were protected to make sure those things wouldn't happen again. But as people wrote at the time or over the course of the years that followed, certain groups were protected to death. They were excluded from research as a matter of their protection.
It's quite a leap to go from protecting them to excluding any members of that demographic from research.
But the regulations that were changed in 1995, so I don't want to give the impression that this is still the case, but the regulations between the mid-1970s and the mid-1990s had special categories of protection for so-called vulnerable subjects, women, because they could be pregnant. So it wasn't so much to protect women. It was to protect the future children that they might bear. Children, because they can't give consent for themselves and are deemed to be vulnerable to being taken advantage of. And prisoners, people who were institutionally held against their will. Those three categories were specially protected. Nothing about African Americans in that sentence. Nothing about people with developmental disabilities, say, but people who you would otherwise think ought to be protected, right? And certainly African Americans weren't excluded as a matter of policy. So there's a looming question here, which we should talk about to follow up on the intro that you started with, is why is it the case that there are still so few people of color enrolling in clinical trials?
And that is, in fact, the case. So here we sit in 2017. There are fewer people of color being tested in clinical trials, and why is that?
There's an underrepresentation. So fewer is a little hard to assess. There are fewer people of color in the population generally, right? So you really want to ask, are they represented as they would be in the population? And are they represented in research as they would be in the population of people affected by the thing we're studying, right? To your point, African Americans are seemingly at higher risk of developing Alzheimer's. Why are there fewer of them in trials to try to assess how to treat Alzheimer's? It's a really important question. We know much, much more about the people who participate in research than we do about the people who don't. And again, that's maybe self-evident, but it's worth saying. Much harder to study people who don't come and participate in research than those that do. And so we actually don't
and
know.
And is that the barrier? Because fewer people are volunteering or signing up? I mean, there is a long, in the African-American community, there's a long history, as you've just elucidated, of mistrust and distrust between African-Americans and the medical science community. And it's well-deserved, that distrust. So is it that they can't be recruited or they're not being asked? I mean, what do you think?
So this is from my experience. I sit on some boards that oversee large national and multinational clinical trials. So from that experience, and from just because I study this as one of my own scholarly areas, it's hard to recruit people of color. So it's not that people don't try; it's that it's difficult, and some of it is for the reasons that you just articulated. There is a history of mistrust, and a sense that I don't want to be participating in something that isn't good for me. I don't want to be a guinea pig. I'm using colloquial language, obviously. The deal in research is we will ask you to participate in something we're uncertain about, right, the benefits of, but we think that the risks are proportionate to the potential benefits. We're not sure. That's why we call it research. And if we don't do research, we won't get to approved therapies that we can use for everybody. So there's a bit of a deal that we're trying to make with people to say, we want you to put yourself in harm's way a bit. We'll protect you, of course. But you're doing this somewhat for yourself, but also for the benefit of people who come after you. And that hasn't resonated with across the population in this country to get full representation of the people in the trials that look like the people in the population.
Well, then let me ask the other question on the other side of this. Why should race, for example, in the case of African Americans? I mean, obviously, women and men, there's a gender difference, and we have some innards that are different. We all have livers and hearts and kidneys, but, you know, not all of us have ovaries or prostates. But why should race matter? I mean, I think we're trying to teach our children that race doesn't matter, that we're all the same inside, you know? There's an article in what was it called? Nature Biotechnology, about 12 years ago, that said, quote, pooling people in race silos is akin to zoologists grouping raccoons, tigers, and okapis on the basis that they're all stripy. Mm-hmm. You know, this article says, you know, you might as well group people by height. I mean, it just doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So why should it matter?
It's a very, very good question. Why does race matter at all when it comes to things like biological difference? It's a really, first of all, it's a sort of third rail in our social policy discussion, right? So even talking about it is controversial. There I think has been both a sense that it shouldn't matter, but then you quoted African Americans seem to be at higher risk or there's greater incidence of Alzheimer's disease in that population. Why? Is it a social factor or is something else going on? We need to know the answer to that to know how to treat populations better. And if there's something biologically different, it would be important to know that. The same article that you just read from was about the first drug that was approved for a particular race of people. It turned out to have been removed from the market. It didn't work that way. And extremely controversial was called Bidyl, which was a drug that two existing drugs for heart disease put together seemed to get a greater response from people who self-identified as African-American than people who were white. Well, what does that mean from a biological perspective? Does self-identification as black mean anything, right? Because that could be everything from Caribbean to African to Latin American.
But again, it was animated by the fact that African-Americans appear to have a higher incidence of congestive heart failure, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, I understand it as a prostate cancer survivor myself. I understand that African Americans have a higher incidence of prostate cancer than white Americans, that Asian Americans have a much lower incidence of prostate cancer than white people or black people. So there are some racial, ethnic divisions in terms of incidence of these diseases. So here's somebody trying to produce a drug that says, okay, knowing that we have a problem in the African-American community, that so many more black folks are getting congestive heart failure than white folks, let's develop a drug that is targeted towards that population. Mm-hmm.
What's wrong
with that?
Right. The question is whether it's because of the way they look, and the answer, I'm saying it that way on purpose. The answer, of course, is no. Something that the people in those categories share, some kind of genetic mutation that's different that has to do with their ethnicity and where the people who preceded them, many, 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 many generations, came from, right? There's sort of this groups of people over the course of human evolution that shared some genetic background. And they look sometimes similar to each other, but sometimes not at all. So what we really want to know is whether, you know, what is it that's common to those populations? It also may be behavioral. Diet is very different among different groups of people, you know, in the same country, in the same society. One other thing to sort of maybe cut against what I just said, there's another very simple sort of observation. So something called the National Marrow Donor Program, which is for people who need bone marrow transplants, and there are people who are strangers willing to be donors to others. You have to match. There's a genetic test that's performed, and if you turn out to be of mixed ancestry, it's much, much, much harder to find somebody that's a match to you in that collection of willing donors than if you're Caucasian.
Yeah.
It just is. So if that's true, then there's something going on when we've got different combinations of people's ancestry. And that, you know, we can't ignore that fact.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, he's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about the ethics of medical research when, as is often the case, the research participants don't reflect the diversity of our society as a whole and why or if this matters. You are welcome to join us when we come back from a break. We have one call, Frank from Aberdeen. Stick on the line. Stay on the line, Frank. We will get to you as soon as we come back. 410-662-8780 is our number. Midday at WIPR.org is our email. Follow us on Twitter at Midday. Tom Hall will be back in a flash. Welcome back. It's Midday. By the way, coming up on the broadcast tomorrow, gardens are in full bloom these days, although today they may be wilting a little bit. Tomorrow, we're going to check in with Carrie Engel, the greenhouse manager at Valley View Farms over in Cockeysville, and Crystal Foreman. She's with the Farm Alliance of Baltimore. We're going to talk veggies and flowers and what we should be planting, what we should be looking forward to be planting, and strategies to help our gardens grow. Carrie Engel and Crystal Foreman will take your calls, your questions, and your comments tomorrow on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Ethics, and my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about the consequences of medical research that's focused too narrowly, and what does it mean for people of color and women if research is conducted largely on white men. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall, or you could drop us an email, Midday at WIPR.org. So, Jeff Kahn, we do have a bunch of folks on the phone. Frank, I promised you that we'd come back to you as soon as we came back from the break. So here we are. You are joining us from Aberdeen. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. In addition to beyond the ethics of the matter, there's a practical consideration. If you have identified a subgroup that is more likely to be afflicted, I would think you would oversample that population in any study.
Yeah, I mean, if previous studies have shown that there's a particular population that has a problem with a certain disease, why not load them up? In the case of Alzheimer's, if we know that there's a high incidence of Alzheimer's in the black community, why not load them up with black subjects?
Yeah, it's a very good point, and thanks, Frank, for raising that. So one thing to say is that research comes impetus and incentive for research comes from various perspectives and directions. So I mentioned the National Institutes of Health, which is government money, right? Funding things that the process of identifying, you know, important questions gets discovered and they fund those things. But there's also industry. And so pharmaceutical companies and biotechnology companies are in the business of performing research in order to bring products to market. So that's all leading me to say there's an incentive to find drugs that can appeal to the widest population possible, right? Not to the narrowest population possible. So there's an issue. It's not even about race. It's about disease. And so there are things called orphan diseases that affect fewer than a couple hundred thousand people in the country, where there's incentives on the part of the Food and Drug Administration to research those those diseases and create drugs for them, because otherwise there'd be no sort of business model for it. And so it's a complicated story, is part of the answer to Frank's question. That said, there's a lot of effort to try to recruit what have been historically underrepresented populations. And I don't want to give the impression that it's like it was in the 1970s or 80s. It's much, much, much better. But it's a difficult thing to recruit actually lots of groups into research. It's not so easy to recruit white men into research. It turns out to be a more difficult thing than one would imagine. And that's due to a few factors. One is people want treatment. They don't want research, right? They don't want experimental, what they think of as experimental stuff. The other is, if you live in Baltimore, then you know about the many hospitals and the trials that may be here because your physician is probably fairly well versed. You come to Johns Hopkins, there's a lot of research going on. But if you don't live in a metro urban part of the United States, how are you supposed to know what's available for your particular disease? And that changed a few years ago. There's a website that the government runs called clinicaltrials.gov, where all clinical trials are registered. So you can actually go online and put in your disease or your diagnosis, and you can find all of the clinical trials that are happening anywhere in the United States that are maybe potentially something you could take advantage of. It's a little problematic for reasons we can talk about, but part of the answer has been information was difficult to find, and you relied on your professional, your healthcare professional, to tell you, oh, there's a trial I heard about. But that totally relies on one individual's happening to be in the know about a particular disease, and that isn't the way we want people to find out about participation opportunities.
Jim in Annapolis, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn.
Hi, thanks. This is a great program. I just want to point out that two of the diseases you mentioned, congestive heart failure and Alzheimer's disease, may actually be similar in appearance at clinical presentation, but they may actually have different origins or different mechanisms in people of different ethnicities. Part of the reason to include people of different ethnicities in clinical trials is to try and tease out whether you're actually looking at, for example, three different disease mechanisms that all present as Alzheimer's or congestive heart failure.
So how does that work, Jeff Kahn? I mean, thank you for your comment, Jim. I mean, isn't congestive heart failure congestive heart failure? How does it present differently? That's interesting.
Well, I'm out of my depth now. But I think to Jim's point, we want to make sure that we're studying the same thing in the groups that we're that are being studied. And so I think all that argues for is greater inclusion of a wider proportion of people who look like they have the same disease based on their symptoms. And so it really is obligatory on the part of those who are engaged in research and who fund research to try to get as wide a representation of those who are affected by whatever is being studied as possible. So it isn't for lack of acknowledging that and recognizing it. It's really just a difficult thing to recruit populations. There's a lot of good work being done at Hopkins. I know it best because that's where I work, and other places around the country. We can talk about the funding that is actually going into helping community outreach and things to help blunt this problem, but it continues to be a problem.
Jim, are you still on the line? No, I guess we've lost Jim. But that's an interesting question about how things can be, the origins can be different. I mean, when it comes to research, one of the fundamental dimensions of this is reproducibility. You know, I'm actually going to be interviewing the NPR correspondent, medical correspondent next week about a book he wrote called Rigor Mortis, meaning the rigor of medical research that's currently happening in the country. His name is Richard Harris, really interesting book and terrifying on a lot of levels, because he says that there's an awful lot of studies that, in fact, cannot be reproduced. And the whole thing about science is that you do a study, you should be able to have three or four or five or however many other labs reproduce it. Is there any evidence to say that lab number one does a study that is largely white men, and lab number two tries to reproduce those results using women and people of color, and there's different results because of the racial and gender makeup of the second sample group?
Yep, sure. And I know Richard's book. I read it myself, and I think it's actually a really interesting set of issues. So I mean, there are many different examples, I'm sure. The one that comes to mind to answer your question is that there's a very famous study called the Doctors Trial, which was to that identified the aspirin a day helps reduce the risk of heart disease in men, right? And that was all white men that study was performed, and it was prior to the change in the policy. And so what had been taken from that research was that if a certain amount of baby aspirin for a man every day reduced the risk of heart disease for him, a smaller dose to represent sort of the smaller size of a woman would be, you know, good for women too. Turned out not to be true. So you can't assume, because you've got a result in one population, that somehow that will translate. You know, we don't think of children as small versions of adults, and we shouldn't think of women as smaller statured men. That doesn't make sense at all.
Was there a particular reason they found that it didn't work for women?
I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm.
But you did, but there was a difference.
Absolutely. And so the recommendation after studying women's health, and there's now a whole office of women's health research at the National Institutes of Health as a result of the sort of observation that we're protecting women for reasons that are not about protecting their health. And thank you very much. From a women's perspective, you protected us to death. We don't know enough about health issues in women. And so that change, it's now not so recent. It's 20-something years ago. But nonetheless, there is underrepresentation among certain populations. So the answer to your question is absolutely yes. And I'm sure there are many other examples. Other people could quote you chapter and verse, but I'm giving you just one as an example.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn from the Berman Institute for Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. It's Midday on Ethics. I'm Tom Hall. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. James in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Kahn.
Good afternoon, Tom and your guests. I would like him to talk about the swine flu vaccine that didn't work and the mistrust that African Americans have for research. Specifically, I mean, we're talking about Johns Hopkins, and because there's always been a story that's passed around that African Americans disappear and from East Baltimore if they stay out late or if they're homeless. That they would be research would be done on them. You never see them again. So African Americans in Baltimore, and specifically, don't trust Johns Hopkins. Number one, number two, and the swine flu was proven to not work. Number three, and he specifically conveyed that testing on people of multiple ethnicity ancestry doesn't work well. But most African Americans have white people who owned them in the previous generations, so most African Americans wouldn't qualify for that with that pretext. So you have to understand, when you're talking about African Americans don't test well, or people who have multiple ethnicities don't test well, mm-hmm. most African Americans have multiple ethnicity in their heritage. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the call, James. I appreciate it. I mean, it brings up a lot of things, and one of them, the fundamental things, is that there is this long history of distrust, particularly in East Baltimore and particularly with Johns Hopkins. We talked about this a couple months ago in the instance of Henrietta Lacks. They just had this movie made out of Rebecca Skloot's book on Miss Lacks, who had these certain kinds of cancer cells that reproduce infinitely and have been used in a lot of research. And Rebecca, you know, reported about this distrust. This is a perception that pertains to this day in East Baltimore. So that's clearly an issue, isn't it?
It is, and it's a lingering issue, I think, that is part of the story that has to do with participation in research. And it's not unique to East Baltimore or to Baltimore. It's a perception, I think, that has run deep and continues. And it's unfortunate, of course, that is the perception. So The history is as we have already articulated, and you're right that the story of HeLa cells and Henrietta Lacks' legacy has been told in Rebecca Skloot's book and in the film that Oprah Winfrey starred in and HBO released just in April. But the history goes back certainly farther than that. We mentioned the Tuskegee so-called syphilis study, and there are other examples. And so part of what we need to say is those. That's all history, and we need to understand and learn from that history, but we need to do better, and we are doing better and trying hard to make the benefits of research available more widely. And so, you know, it is to protect people from being misused, but at the same time, we don't want to overprotect them. So that's the challenge. And James is absolutely right that people are not pure. None of us are pure, right? It doesn't make sense to even talk about...
In terms of ethnic...
Our ancestries are all mixed, and that's why people are interested in Ancestry.com and 23andMe, these online sites where you can send in a sample of your DNA and your ancestry mixture will come back. It's fascinating to people, but none of us are pure anything. And so what we need to be able to do is figure out what's different about people. Maybe it's a genetic difference. So that's something that you can't see. It doesn't have to be how you look. It's what is driving the difference in the way disease presents and also in the way treatment works or won't. So there's lots of work now around certain cancer diagnoses. I mean, maybe you have this experience yourself where certain kinds of cancer respond to certain kinds of treatment. And that's a genetic feature of the cancer, right? Not of the person, but of the cells that are replicating out of control in your body. That's what cancer
and
is.
Now with this whole thing of personalized medicine,
absolutely,
they're trying to look at, you know, what is the cancer doing in this particular body and how can it be
absolutely. And so this notion of personalized medicine is something that's trying to get at what's special about you. It doesn't matter how you look. It matters about what your genome looks like. Now, to James' point about, he mentioned swine flu vaccine, and there's examples of other. So vaccines are population-based approaches to prevention, right? And they're not made to work for any one person. They're made to work across a population. Sometimes they work better than others. And so I don't know exactly which vaccine James was mentioning, but sometimes they are quite ineffective. And it's not for lack of trying. It's a prediction about what the particular, it's a flu in this case, is going to be this coming flu season. And sometimes the people who are putting the flu vaccine together get it right, and sometimes they get it less right. But it's meant to provide population-based protection so that even if not everybody gets immune response, enough people do such that the disease won't spread among those who don't get immune response. Maybe that's too technical, but we can talk more if you want.
Let's try to get another call. Keith in Baltimore, welcome to Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Hello, gentlemen. Dr. Kahn, Tom, thank you for having my call. My question basically is a very good segue. I've seen the progression of the calls that have come so far. Is some of the underlying factors of research, and this question reflects some of that. My daughter was involved with a doctor researcher, you know, like that happens a lot of times, and I remember you mentioned that before, Dr. Kahn. It wasn't a study, it wasn't a proper trial, but she was given some medication. She was immunocompromised, and she later suffered a severe brain injury. And the thing is, everybody, I think, including myself, understood some of the progress. But at the end, and this might be an underlying question that, like I said, people can't bring to the surface, but with this across the board of studies of race, whatever it may be, what happens when something like this goes on? Are you made whole? Are people coming up forward and saying, yes, this is what happened, sorry? Are you signing a disclaimer, or are you being made whole, or is there going to be some long fought, slogged out fight that, with, of course, the way MedMal practices today, it's just going to injure people further who have already been injured? Can you tell me what's going on with that to help in research?
Well, thanks for that call, Keith, and I'm so sorry that your family's had to. Do you mind my asking before Dr. Kahn answers your very good questions? How is your daughter now? She said she had some difficulties and some brain injuries. Has she recovered from those, or are those chronic?
Oh, sure. I'm willing to answer that more specifically outside of my general question. Yeah, she was immunocompromised. She suffered she had TB. I mean, I'm bombarded with this on a daily basis by the new drugs that are on TV today. And she did disseminate, got in her central nervous system, got in her brain, and TB is slow to grow, slow to kill. And technically, she probably should have died, but she's not doing too bad as far as someone who had their brain mushed up pretty good, basal meningeal thickening, infarcts left and right everywhere. But she does need 24-hour-a-day care, which she was young. So this is a lifetime. Nobody wants to dish out the cash for that.
Sure.
So it just ended up becoming incredibly difficult. But that aside, what for all these people out there that are thinking, you know, why should I trust? I heard the lady say before and all this. I think people would be a little bit more forthcoming to, and healthy people for that matter, if they just knew they weren't going to be left hanging at the end of the study.
Well, thank you again for giving us an insight from a family that's had to deal with this in a very real way. Jeff Kahn.
Thank you, Keith, for your question and your sharing your story. There's an interesting difference. So in the context of treatment by a physician or a healthcare provider or a hospital, if something bad happens and there's malpractice, there are means by which to receive compensation. So liability, medical malpractice, that whole process. In research, that is not the case. So there is no such thing as medical malpractice in the context of research. It doesn't make sense to even talk that way. And when people are recruited into a trial and receive information, end up reviewing a consent form and go through that process and sign a consent document, they always say that you will not be compensated for an injury that may occur to you. Generally, the people who, if they're injured, and it's luckily very rare, their health care is provided, but there's no compensation, as would be the case sometimes in a medical malpractice suit. So very different environments, and it makes some sense, right? Because we are in a context in research where we're not sure. That's why we call it research. Otherwise, we would call it therapy. There isn't a sort of equivalent to malpractice because it isn't clear what practice ought to be in the research context. And so there is a kind of a gap in policy in terms of what happens when people are injured in research.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us every couple of months for Midday on Ethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. And by the way, we've got a link to the Berman Institute on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up more with Dr. Kahn, 410-662-8780 is the number to call after we take this little break. Midday at wypr.org is our email. You can follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. We'll be right back. Back. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, it's another installment of Midday on Ethics. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and he joins us regularly to sift through timely issues in bio and medical ethics. Today, we've been talking about the ethics of diversity in clinical research in medicine. 410-662-8780 is our number, our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Let's go back to the phones. Scylla in Baltimore, welcome to the program. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much. I wanted first to offer a appreciation to the experimental team at Hopkins on dealing with cardiomyopathy. They treated my husband many years ago, and though he did not make it, they took excellent care of him and were more than heroic in doing so. My question is regarding their follow-up of my kids, basically, because of their father's disease being genetic. One of my sons is now transgender, and I'm curious to know how they are approaching the transgender community, given their special needs in ongoing care.
Sure.
Research.
Sure. Thanks for that call, and we're sorry for your loss, Scylla. That's thing that folks in your business have to wrestle with now, the transgender community.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for your call, Scylla. There are sort of two parts I'll respond to. One, I think, is your question. I think about genetic follow-up for children of somebody who had a particular disorder. You mentioned cardiomyopathy in their father. So there certainly are studies of families who seem to have a genetic risk for a particular disease, and that large groups of, sort of cohort studies, people who seem to be at risk and how to treat them and what the risks are and how they can predict those risks. So that's something that you ought to know about and follow up if you don't already know about it. In terms of the transgender community, there are increasing numbers of clinics that are specific to healthcare for transgender people. It isn't so much about research on them and as clinical trials on people who are transgender, but rather dealing with the particular healthcare needs of people who are transgender. And that's certainly a recognized area of healthcare that didn't exist until quite frequently, quite recently, pardon me, and that we're seeing much more frequently instituted in medical centers and hospitals and outpatient clinics around the country. So I think that's actually a growing area and an important one.
And it must be very confusing. I mean, if you're born a man and you trans to female, you've still got the male heart, the male liver, the male kidney that you were born with, and would your proclivities for particular diseases then be premised on your maleness or premised on, you know, what would it be premised on?
Well, that's a good question, and again, I don't know the answers to your very good questions, but there also are hormones which people take when they transition from one to another.
Which would change the playing field, right?
The physiology. So all of that is, of course, what people need to take into account when they're treating people who are transitioned or transitioning.
Here's an email from Monica who says, I know I've experienced issues with drugs that are too strong for me at their standard prescribed strength. I'm thinking of things like Chantix and Vicodin and Flexerol, all of which were too strong for me. So how has this white men only testing methodology affected, for example, opioid addiction in women?
Right. That's a really good question. And I would say it's not only about men versus women, but rather individual variation. And it's well known. It's an area that people study called pharmacogenetics, where your particular physiology will either be faster or slower at metabolizing a particular drug than somebody else's. And it's important for, as the science progresses, for people to know what the answer to that question is for themselves. Because when you buy something over the counter or are prescribed it, it's printed on the back, right, what the dose is. But that's the dose for the population. That's not the dose that may necessarily be right for you. And part of that has been trial and error. So I hope in cases like you're describing that you talk to your physician and tailor the dose. But I think soon enough will be the case that among the things that precision medicine offers is what's the right dose of this drug for you. And so rather than taking, you know, 3 ibuprofen, maybe you should only take 2, or maybe you need to take 4 because of the way your body metabolizes. And we'll know much more about that as this area progresses.
Because there's a lot of factors that go into how your body metabolizes, right? I mean, if you have a 45-year-old black male who weighs 150 pounds, will he automatically metabolize, you know, alcohol or ibuprofen or anything differently than a 45-year-old white woman who's also 150 pounds?
The answer, I'm sure, is yes. But the question is how much, right? That's what we need to have better information about. And certainly we can all relate to the fact that as we age, our bodies change and our tolerance for certainly alcohol. If you drink alcohol, you notice that. You're either more or less sensitive. People will report both things, which is also interesting. Why is that the case? Some people seem to have higher tolerance, some people lesser tolerance as they age. So what's going on? That's all about, as you say, what causes the changes in our metabolism. There's a lot of work around pharmacogenomic and metabolism and something called the cytochrome pathways that people are studying to try to answer that question. And so we will all have more information about that for ourselves in the coming years. Absolutely, that will be the case.
So circling back to this issue of the fact that there's such a high incidence of Alzheimer's in the African-American community, African-Americans represent more than 20% of the 5.5 million people in America who have this disease, but they account for only 3 to 5% of the trial participants. Do people think that if they accounted for, you know, 20% of the trial participants, that we would have a clearer, more acute, you know, better grasp of what's going on as Alzheimer's develops in all patients?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would the research be better?
Well, that's the right question to ask, and we won't know the answer to it unless we have more people in studies that represent different groups, different parts of the population. And so what researchers care a lot about is power, and that isn't the sense of power over people, but rather power in their studies, a statistical concept. You need enough people to generate data about them such that the results that you find are meaningful. And so part of the challenge is getting enough people who represent a group, whatever that group gets categorized as being, to give you information that's actually meaningful. That's the key. And that's the goal of greater inclusion, to get more power. So I would say, now to sort of talk ethics, we have an obligation to do that, right? We have to do better. We have not done well by this question. And so the key is, how can we do better? One answer was more information. So you can go on the web, if you're web savvy, and find all the clinical trials that you might want to participate in, whether it's about the particular disease or diagnosis, or just because you're interested in going into a drug trial and you're a healthy person. That's open to you as well, because you're altruistic. But until we figure out all the combinations of things that motivate people and how to get a wider representation of people in research, we're not going to know the answer to the question that you asked.
I wonder if it's also a generational thing in medicine. I mean, 50 years ago, most of the doctors were white men. Right. And they're treating white men, and they're researching using white men as subjects. Now you go to medical schools and there are all sorts of women and people of color in the medical profession. And I wonder if they have a general inclination to include people of different, of more diverse races and ethnicities, simply because they themselves.
Well, and if the people who are caring for you look more like you than not, then that obviously changes the way you think about the people who are in that profession. That said, there's this lingering historical mistrust of among certain parts of the population of institutions. So it's the place, too. It's not just the notion of medical research. It's the place where it's performed. And so all of that needs to be worked through, understood, acknowledged. But we want to help the population that seems to be resistant to participating. It isn't because we want to use them. You know, to the extent that I live in that world, that, of course, is not the motivation. And so that is the message that needs to be understood, talked through, communicated. It isn't all about, let me tell you. I want to hear from you about what it is that's bothering you. Why are you not interested if you're not? And see if we can't figure out a way to meet in the middle.
Karen, welcome to the program. We got about a minute for your quick question. Thanks for your call.
Oh, actually, it's more of a comment. I've been a nurse for 40 years, so I've had many anecdotes where medications affect people differently, and I always try to train young nurses that with certain medications, you'd be very careful. Obviously, narcotics comes to mind, but there's a couple of anti-nausea drugs, Phenergan and Compazine, and I've given like an adult, full adult dose to a little old lady who for some reason was used to it or metabolized it well, and she was fine. And I've given a half or a quarter dose to big grown men, and then you can't wake them up for about 8 or 12 hours. So there's a something about certain medications and the way that they're metabolized. And as a senior nurse, I try to educate my younger colleagues about, you know, if this is the first time somebody's getting something, be really careful. Better to give a half dose or even a quarter dose and, you know, not have to be in there waking them up every 5 minutes for the next, you know, 12 hours.
Yeah, and that's wonderful that you were able to apply that, you know, wealth of experience to that. But, you know, medicine is a science, but it's an art too, isn't it?
Well, right, and certainly experience on the part of individuals to say, you know, I'm really sensitive to this medication, something you learn from just experience. But the other is there will be more information, a combination of genetic and behavioral and lifestyle all put together in what is being called precision medicine that will help inform exactly the question that Karen is articulating.
All right. Thanks for the call, Karen. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me every other month here on Midday to help us make sense of some of the ethical questions that surround medical research, as well as social and corporate practices that affect all aspects of our lives. Jeff Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, and we've got a link to the institute at wypr.org/midday. Thanks, Jeff. We'll see you next time.
Sure. Look forward to it.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, if you're a gardener or if you're thinking about starting a garden, we'll have two experts here in studio to take your questions and comments about what to plant and how to make it grow. Carrie Engel from Valley View Farms and Crystal Foreman of the Farm Alliance of Baltimore will be here with tips for making your thumb as green as it can get. So if you can join us tomorrow on Midday. And a reminder that coming up in about an hour and a half, Attorney General Jeff Sessions will testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. WYPR will carry NPR's live coverage that begins at 2:30 this afternoon. Lunch for our guest today was provided by Joe's Squared. Joe's Squared serves cold-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. We appreciate your spending part of your afternoon with us. Have a great day.